Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. For the second time this month, we discuss game design, but also stuff. This is what we like to call an addendum episode. Our first full slot in the schedule as a monthly episode, but this time and in future, these will be more sort of periodic bonus episodes, allowing us to look back on some things, answer questions, and bring up some topics that we'd like to talk about that might not fit into an actual episode.
I think the first time we did this, we actually had a short list of things that we thought we should have brought this up, we should have talked about it this way. We haven't had that urge in a while, which is why we haven't had an addendum episode in a while.
Yeah, and I think like we were sort of, there's a bit of like, oh, we're midway through what we're currently doing, we'll wait till the end of Dominant Strategies, so here we are too.
So here we are. And so we don't have a particular list of things we wanted to talk about, but we thought it would be nice to get an introspective look at our own thought processes for the way we run things, the way we plan things. Maybe some people are interested in how we come to some decisions for like which games and stuff. Demystify some of that, right?
Yeah, we're going to demystify some of that. And so first up, we're going to do a bit of, I guess, introspective looking. So we talk about a lot of different games and also a lot of similar games because we all have biases and, you know, we don't play everything. So I think there are two sort of main genres that I think we have some issues with and a few others individually.
There are definitely a small laundry list of games and game types that we just probably will always have trouble talking about.
Yeah, so one I think that is probably the most mutual is fighting games, because we both really like fighting games, and that's sort of the issue, is that we're very, very deep into the specifics of that culture, and that makes it very hard sometimes to not talk about them from that perspective.
I don't know how many listeners who consistently could ever pick this out, but we get so careful when we have a fighting game topic. I feel like my speech slows down by a percentile, and I'm consciously deliberating on every word that I'm saying.
Yeah, we're really trying to straddle a line of like, we want to give in to our passions of the genre, but we also want to keep it easy to follow. Like, we had the story modes and fighting games episode a long time ago, and we didn't strike that balance enough, and so since then it's been a bit of a caution point. I feel like we've almost settled on Smash as like the default fighting game that we don't run that risk with.
Yeah, that's helped.
Even though we do run the risk.
Yeah, it's helped by the fact that we've talked about it in so many different angles that in our brain we feel like we can justify talking about slightly deeper mechanics because, hey, if you've been following along, you might have caught up to what we're talking about, you know, just casually.
And unfortunately also, it's just more popular than Melty Blood,
which is
an injustice, but like it is a truism, and it helps that people just know what we're talking about when we bring up a Smash thing, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it's less pressure on us to explain it as perhaps thoroughly as we might need to for a fighting game in our examples.
Definitely. The way I see it is like this, right? With Smash, for most people, even if they haven't played it, they immediately get a mental image of what Smash looks like. So that's one thing we don't have to provide in our discussion. But when we talk about more esoteric fighting games, we have to first establish what the feel of game is before we can even talk about the specific mechanic or design that we're there for.
Mm. And because it's sort of a specific genre that is sort of popular, but also a lot of people don't play often, pointing out like the game feel and how it's genuinely different to other things can be very difficult in a lot of cases, I feel.
Absolutely.
And I always feel like, because I love fighting games so much, I want to like communicate very specifically how like joyous the system might be or not. And that's difficult in audio only as well.
Yeah, that's another problem is everyone likes to share something that makes them happy. Fighting games make both of us happy.
As do a lot of other games. But yeah, fighting games are a key thing for us.
They are. So, yeah.
But then there are...
As a just very brief glimpse behind the curtain. If you ever see us talking about fighting games, we're going to have this like kind of caution about it. But yes, there are, in fact, other genres which go a bit further where we have inherent built-in biases that may disqualify this game from ever being talked about.
Yeah, you've got a particularly big one that I'm also, like, I'm more just ignorant in it. You have a more passionate dislike for it, I think.
Yeah. I hate the genre name, which is never a good sign.
You don't need to say, we're going to call it by the proper genre name. That is now official Platforms and Pitfalls canon.
Oh, what genre name were you going to go for? This is a surprise to me.
We can call them... Aeon of Strife likes.
Oh,
that's a good name, isn't it?
That is so nice of you. Yes, I for those of you who are not, I'm an adult. I can get past this. For any listener who's not fully aware, the term MOBA stands for Multiplayer Online Battle Arena, which to me is a very weird, non-meaningful name. But
to be fair, though, all video game genres are pretty. We live in a world with RPGs. And JRPGs, that JRPGs can be made by people not in Japan.
Yeah.
So genre is broken. Like, it is established.
Absolutely is. Again, bias. I hate this more than the other. Why? Because I'm me. Not because there's a good reason. So, yeah, the game that people call MOBAs, I know as Aeon of Strife games because I know it from the very first MOBA, which was called Aeon of Strife. But that's not a very meaningful name. It's like saying Portal's a Doom clone.
I mean, you say it's not a very meaningful name, but we also currently have a lot of discussion with the use of Souls-like or the use of Roguelike. Yep. Roguelike is a very well-established term, and there's certainly, like, it's a term that's sort of held to some gatekeeping standards.
It is.
But it's come in a lot of different ways over the years, and now it's so disassociated from its origin that it's fascinating.
I guess my point is we're never going to get to the any kind of saturation for bringing AOS back into the colloquialism.
Yeah. And I think, like, MOBAs, there's such a huge time investment to really getting into those games that I feel like, you know, you might be able to talk about Aeon of Strife and Dota. I can't gain that literacy in a reasonable time frame.
That's right, yes. There is a level of just if you don't spend 500 hours playing one of these, you're going to struggle to understand why anyone is doing specific things. Like the we're talking about the micro decisions, not the big one, not the macro ones. Okay, they're pushing the tower. You can understand that within your first hour of gameplay. But design decisions that cause micro changes in behavior, when to leave the jungle, when to push econ, when to... Yeah, even all of that, right? Like, that's all very problematic to talk about.
Yeah, and I guess it sort of ties into how, like, deeply we dive into a single title. Like, we sometimes people describe what we do as deep dives. We might dive deep into a topic, but we don't deep dive into a game. We take a good glance and a good look and do some research on it, but we're not doing the most elaborate deep dive on a single title.
I like to think of it as we cheat. Instead of going deep on one mechanic by just saying, this game did this, here's why not, we go, here's five ways to do it.
Yeah, because context is important. Nothing stands alone in media in general. And so it's important to look at lots of different things.
Yeah.
But that sort of just means that we can't really talk about really, really, really complicated long form things without just already have been into them. Like, we can't decide now is the time to talk about Path of Exile because that's 1,000 hours to be able to say anything useful. We talked about Diablo 3 in one episode because you knew a lot. We can do Granblue because I'd already just invested in that separately. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to suddenly be like, and next week we're talking about Valorant because we can't get there.
I have some Counter-Strike experience, not enough to talk about Valorant.
I can't play first person shooters really.
That is another very fair point. So there will always be some games that you would think, oh, that's an easy example, why don't they talk? Chances are, if it's a service game, chances are we just don't have time. And here's the thing as well, right? All the examples we mentioned there, they're service games.
Well, we could bring up some non-service game examples quite easily, I think. Like, a lot of shooting games are kind of out of my range. Mm-hmm. I probably stretch a little bit even for Command & Conquer. Like, but I mean, it's a new game experience.
Covered shooters, right? Like, Kane and Lynch Deadman has been part of something we've talked about.
That's true. Yeah, we talked about them in antagonistic co-op.
And when they're bite-sized enough for us to be able to take a decent stab at it and be able to say,
that's true. Yeah,
by putting in 2 hours, we'll get X percent of the way through. We get a much more realistic understanding of whether or not we can put something in and plan for it. But when it's a lifetime service game kind of deal, that becomes so nebulous.
It really does.
Like, even with your experience and my experience in Warframe, you have more than I do.
And which is not enough to have done, like, the cool, awesome story content.
No, it's not.
At, like, 70 hours-ish that I put in.
Yeah, it's really, really not. And Warframe is such a cool game. Warframe is such a cool game.
It'd be discredit to not have gotten to those things that make it really amazing, because that is a big part of what it is.
Mm.
And I'd be happy to talk about some of the loops in it and things, but it's still, like, as a whole experience, I can't do a deep dive on that, even though it's 70 hours in.
Yeah, and that's mind-boggling to me when you put it that way, but it's absolutely true. That's not to say that there is no avenue for a discussion on some of these kinds of games, right? Because there is a world where we get an expert in.
And we've already talked about, like, a few service games. Like, you talked about Firefall?
Yeah.
Firewatch?
Yeah. Firefall.
We've done Granblue.
Yep.
So, like, there is small rooms if we happen to just be personally very invested in one of them.
Correct.
But yeah, there's a lot of spaces that we can't really talk about because we can't get what we perceive to be the adequate knowledge for, because our dives, we have to go too broad to dive that deep sometimes.
Yeah. And that's a lot to say about something that we don't do. But part of the process over the past, so the last time we had an addendum was a year and a half ago. And a lot of things internally have changed, and at the same time, not very much has changed. One of the very conscious efforts that we had was crediting games.
And it's really complicated. There are so many avenues and issues into who is the maker of a game. You have the auteur, like, this is Heavy Rain by David Cage, which is true, but also a lie, because a lot of people made that game, yep, but are not David Cage. A lot, yep, of what makes that game interesting and good and bad is not just him.
Yep.
And part of that's a marketing thing, but even when you get to titles that aren't directly, like, associated with a name, like if we look at
Tom Clancy. Oh.
Oh, well, there's that too. Like Sid Meier's Civilization that he didn't really do much on in the last few editions. But even outside, like, the classic auteur, like, who do we say made Lost Dimension? Is it this person, this person? Is it this developer? Is it this publisher? Like, there's a lot of nuance. And then we can't list the 100 people that made something.
No.
Because that's terrible audio, honestly. But it's like, who are the makers of games is a really complicated question that we're struggling to solve. I've currently sort of run with, I go to, like, a games credit list, grab producers, designers, and directors if they're separate directors to those roles,
mm-hmm,
and leave it at that. Producers do a lot for games and don't often get a lot of credit in the process, but I think they're important.
Yep.
But, like, we're leaving out a lot of people.
And there's a lot of case-by-case basis with this. There's a lot of feeling out what we think is right to say. And none of this is to really whinge. I think it's what we want to bring up with this is...
Yeah, we want you, the listener, to be aware that when we give credits to a game, we're giving a very limited idea of who made it.
Mm.
And I think it's worth just being aware of who makes things you like.
Yep.
And whether that's, like, you associate a game with the developer more than the people or the people more than the game is an interesting point. I think a good-ish example of this would be, like, Metal Gear. Metal Gear is not a Konami game. To many people's minds, it's a Kojima game, Kojima Productions, which is a separate, and it's linked, but then there's many more names to that than just Kojima.
It's also something that's worth talking about more. This is a force that's kind of moving through the industry and games in general, where a bit more emphasis is being placed on the people and not the company.
Yes, so we've had from just, like, the news stories about crunch and things to just, like, a greater emphasis on developers in interviews and promotional materials.
Yeah. And keep in mind as well, here's something cool, right? we've come so far. There was a point in the 90s where developers were discouraged from putting their real names in credits.
Yeah, like in the 80s even, like a lot of developers put in secret Easter eggs that had their name in the game because they weren't allowed to be properly credited.
That's so crazy. So,
and in Japan in the 80s and 90s, a lot of developers had to use pseudonyms because they didn't want another company trying to hire the employees.
Yeah.
But now we can actually just find lists of people who worked on good stuff on websites like Moby Games and such, which have great credits lists.
Unfortunately, some developers will actually be lost to time. Some credits will be lost to time. That's no great surprise with how things had to be. But it's cool that
I don't want to say had to be. How things were.
How things were. That's right. Absolutely. No. Absolutely. That's how things were. And it was wrong then. It's wrong now to ever do something like that.
Yeah.
But there's
And the way we talk about things is important. I think it's very easy to accidentally forget that a developer is more than just either a few names or just more than its name. Like, Xenoblade is made by Monolith Soft is a true statement, but it misses a lot. But at the same time, giving all that context is hard. So yeah, when listening to things, if you find a game that you like and you're interested in an aspect of it, you should try looking at those credits and finding out who did what and seeing what else they did. Because Japanese credits especially have a lot of breakdown of like battle planner, scenario planner, systems planner and things. And tracking down like the credits of the Persona 5 UI team leads you in a lot of interesting spots, actually.
Unfortunately, okay, be prepared if you do this. You will accidentally kill some of the magic.
Yes.
You will suddenly realize that this amazing piece of media did not spring fully formed from the brow of Zeus. You will start to see the iterations of how we got to where we are, which to some people is cool. But it does break a bit of the magic of like, how is this so crazy? It's like, well, we took baby steps.
Yeah, like seeing the arc of like how certain like developers got to certain systems being how they were, I think is much more fun than just like, and it's just really good. But we're definitely not the norm in that sense, I guess.
I don't know. Maybe a lot of people enjoy this as well, and they just haven't had the time to go and look at it.
Yeah.
Here's an example that comes to mind immediately. From Software, what was the game before Demon's Souls?
Before Demon's Souls, Kingsfield.
Kingsfield, that's the one. I loved watching footage of Kingsfield.
And then the Shadow Tower as well, which is like a little bit more Dark Souls than Kingsfield was.
But it was so great because, to me, I could see where One Direction was going for this, and that in some ways that would have been a very logical conclusion, but very clearly history showed us that they went in the other direction towards Demons and Dark Souls.
Yeah.
And that was fascinating. Super cool.
Yeah, the long form arcs of like small developers like that just do a thing and at one point they get successful is just always so gratifying. Like even just Atlus and just seeing like Shin Megami Tensei become a thing that people care about, even if it's just like the Persona sub-series.
Yeah, like I can imagine that if a Shin Megami Tensei came out now, they'd be scrambling for ways to connect it back to Persona when it's the complete opposite, right?
Yeah, and they kind of have. So since Persona, we've had Shin Megami Tensei 4.
Yeah.
And that definitely leaned more in like classical anime art than it did in the classic SMT art style.
Yeah.
So it's already like had influences on the main franchise.
Yeah, it bleeds back in.
Yeah. But talking about a lot of things, we'd like to add a little bit to our episode about game loops and time. So we actually have a bit of an actual addendum part to add to one of the episodes. We did Game Loops in Time at the start of last year, and we looked at a bunch of games like Granblue and Monster Hunter and how they had game design that related specifically to the length of their gameplay loops and such, and how that was a big factor. And a game I played shortly after that episode was Alter Ego by Caramel Column. It is a clicker game on Android and mobile phones, and it's very clever about how it uses free-to-play mechanics and its time constraints to make a story effective. Mm-hmm. So you, in a lot of stories that we like, we start reading them and then we finish reading them and they're done. And in a modern binge watching culture, we can forget what happened in our stories quite often. I'm sure you've had things like that happen to you, right?
Absolutely. We consume so much media that I feel that I'm particularly good at keeping track of plot points, but there's no way I remember the plot points of everything I've ever seen.
For sure. And what's really cool about this game, which is a visual novel that does its choices through personality tests, which is a really cool like structure to start with, it gates the next part of the story through a sort of meditative clicker sort of experience that means you have to consume it in a sort of paced manner. And I felt that was really interesting that just that extra time between getting more story allowed for some sort of meditation on the topics. And being a clicker, you have to deal with the aesthetics and the very good atmosphere that the game has in its limited amount of UI and such. So that you spend a lot of time just dwelling on what's going on in the tale before you get to its conclusion. And I'm not sure it's good. Like, I don't think it's necessarily worth the time it asks you to burn to get to where it ends up. But I think it stays with me for so long because it just asked me to stay with it for so long.
Stockholm Syndrome?
In a good way?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of Stockholm Syndrome to it, but I think a lot of it is like, it was a good clicker. Like, that is a satisfying thing. It was a good story. Maybe it didn't need to be as long as it needed to be time-wise, but like, it kept me just dwelling on a game that's about like consciousness and ideas, which I think is very cleverly meta.
Yep. Here's something that's a fact about video games. Video games take a lot longer than almost any other media to consume.
Yes.
And time, temporally, contextually, has something to do with how much we invest in and relate to characters.
Yeah, like we brought up in our episode even with Persona 4. Like, not only is the short length of the loops part of it, but the fact that it takes 80 hours to complete does change the relationship to you and those characters. Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not real, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty artificial on some level. Like at some way of looking at it, it's their characters written with a good amount of dialogue and personality and interactions, but they're still pretty shallow characters at the end of the day for the amount of time you've spent with them.
Yeah, like they have a few personality quirks. You could generally... They're great for fan fiction because like they're really clear about what they would do in every situation.
Yeah. So like that. I guess the point I was getting to is that I'm really excited for when this medium is older. I think part of it is that video games are still young. And so our characters are still relatively young and shallow.
Yeah, they're young and they want to draw in other media very strongly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so by using, I like this idea of like using the clicker mechanics, these free-to-play mechanics to actually tell the story. Like, I don't think I've seen a free-to-play game use the free-to-playness of it to communicate something. I'm not sure it's good in that sense. Like, I don't think I like that the story uses money to tell its story, but it's cool.
Yeah, and, I think, like, we need to explore all of this, right?
Yeah, we need to explore all this. There's lots of ways in which we can tell stories, and a lot of them we don't use very often, partially because people might think, that looks scammy, that looks problematic, in terms of like how money is spent, because some of them are.
Here's a very interesting comparison that is totally relevant. Very recently, a VR game called Groundhog Day, like Father, like Son, or something like that, was released.
Mm-hmm.
It is a full storied sequel to Groundhog Day, the movie, in VR.
Oh, that's interesting.
Where you are the son of the Bill Murray character and have to Groundhog Day your way through a Memorial Day to your father. And you start with his life in sort of shambles, you know, the family's arguing with each other, his girlfriend calls on the phone to scream at him. He's this kind of almost successful blogger that's trying to make it big. And there's a lot of like retelling of the values from Groundhog Day in this VR environment, but with game mechanics. And it's very video gamey in some respects because you get to just retry sections. And the implication is that you had to go through the whole day to get there. But it's super cool in a game loop sense as well. Like it's just totally what we're talking about here.
Yeah, in a very literal loop sense even.
Yeah. If you don't have the opportunity to play with it in VR, as I don't at the moment, I would recommend actually looking up some gameplay of it. Because it's really cool. And there's a lot more effort into telling a cohesive story in a very movie sense, because obviously it's borrowing from that. Some VR things.
Yeah, VR is a really interesting space, both in terms of like exploring narratives, but also just in time. Like, a lot of people find VR hard to engage with for like very long form things.
Yep, absolutely.
And part of that's just the tech might not be there yet. I think a lot of people seem to have had more success with Valve's Index than other devices for longer form play with things like Project Alex, Half-Life Alex.
Yep.
Yeah. But thinking of elaborate experiments, we also want to talk about another game that we talked about in that episode a little bit, Asura's Wrath, which you are very passionate about, I really like, and was kind of the reason the episode existed to start with.
Yeah.
Because it's a game that's not designed to be played in long form sessions. Like, it's supposed to be played like a weekly TV show almost. That was the impetus for choosing to look at it. But you raised the question of like, should we? Like, are there things that maybe games just shouldn't bother doing? Because Asura's Wrath was widely panned for feeling repetitive, feeling like it was like difficult to play for long sessions, even though that was the explicit goal of it, almost.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the designers were explicitly thinking, but like the way it's structured is clearly modeled off a certain kind of TV show.
Let's not make assumptions on the intent of the developers, but let's say this. A game that is modeled after television episodes may by consequence feel bad when you binge it.
In the same way that a lot of non-serial television can feel bad when binging. Like, if you binge Power Rangers, that is a very different experience to watching it week by week.
Yeah, like, it just starts even day to by day. Blend. Especially with the pedal to the metal pacing of Asura's Wrath. It does have downtime, right? Like, it's not like Asura's Wrath is only at maximum all the time. It does actually have downtime. It does have introspection. But it's also a video game that is high octane. So you are at, like, not, if not maximum, like, full gauge for a lot of the time, for a lot of the experience. And then gets tiring.
There's a question like, should a game be like exhausting like that? There's a lot of discussion around like, should games invoke feelings that aren't just joy or power fantasy? And but even just like structurally, like, should Asura's Wrath be this quick time event collection?
Yeah,
even though it's a little bit more than that, there is actual systems, but a lot of it is in that structure.
You know, people more eloquent than us have done video essays on some of the amazing things that is Asura's Wrath. And they have answered that question probably better than we can in terms of what makes the QuickTime events all better. But yeah, it was created and released at a time when QuickTime events were considered lazy. In hindsight, it was
a weird time when like they were at the height of QuickTime events being a thing, but at the start of the downfall of QuickTime events, like when people dramatically didn't like them.
Yeah. And in hindsight now, when we go back and look at it, Asura's Wrath QuickTime events are not lazy. They are amazing ways to convey power fantasy to the player and still allow you, the player, to actually watch what's going on screen.
Mm. They're very coherent. They're consistent, like which button is doing what thing and all that sort of stuff. Like, it's a very clever evolution of things like Dragon's Lair, which at the time, if we look back uncharitably, they look fairly random, but they do a lot of work to like guide your eye and such to the right buttons and directions. Asura's Wrath is the next step in that, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a bit of, how do I put it? I really admire the fact that you can, while you're playing Asura's Wrath, still watch Asura's Wrath. More than one game has had really cool effects that I am not watching because all of my focus is on, you know, somewhere else on the screen that's feeding me the information to be able to play the game correctly. Or
very Hatsune Miku, Project Diva sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Or even like Guitar Hero and DDR.
Oh, it's so cool. What's happening in the background? I see none of it. I wish I could look up and see it, but I can't. I have to look at this small portion of the screen or everything will just fall apart.
And Asura's Wrath always uses its QuickTime inputs to like lead your eye to what it's relating to as well.
Yep. Absolutely.
It's a very cool game. I hope that it comes to a new platform one day.
Yeah, I would love to be able to like sit down with it and just pick through all of it. And so in terms of the questions of like, should it have been made? Absolutely, it should have been made. I'm so glad it existed. It's one of these games that I will point to and say, that's art. We've talked a lot about games that are art, and plenty out there. So many interesting things, so many interesting experiences. One of the important things about art is what it makes you feel. Asura's Wrath makes me feel like I want to talk about Asura's Wrath.
I mean, it's a big misconception in art that you have to be dealing with like a certain subset of emotions, like, ah, The Last of Us is art because it's dealing with like life and death and the hardship of humanity, which like Last of Us is very good and I'd happily call it art, but that's not the only kind of thing that is art.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that one of the things that Asura's Wrath did, right, is, hey, this thing, which is like, it effectively has three game modes, which we talked about in the episode. It has this kind of very mediocre brawler section. It has this Panzer Dragoon-ish section, which was decent. And then it has this like really masterfully done quick time event section. And it's just pushing those three as far as they can in the scope that they can. I'm really glad that we have room now for developers, indie developers especially, to just go, I want to push this one system as far as it can go. And then on the other side of this process, go, here it is. This is what I've done with it. And it doesn't have to be this full price game. And it can just be this one system that's pushed as far as they can take it.
And I only just thought this as we were speaking, but like, it wouldn't surprise me that if in some ways Asura's Wrath helped lead to Sayonara Wild Hearts, which is in many ways actually a very similar game.
It is. Absolutely.
In a very different way.
Oh, yeah.
But like, they're both like these, like, we have like a few gameplay modes, a bunch of quick time events. Of course, Sayonara Wild Hearts is less obvious in what is a quick time event and what is just like pressing buttons in a system, but they're very similar pieces of work in that sense.
Yeah.
Like how they are just like progressing you through this increasingly elaborate setup of stuff.
Yeah.
But I think we've gotten through sort of our own question we wanted to raise. We have some questions from our audience that we'd like to work through. So we got two main questions, one of which we got from multiple people, from both Dennis and Jude, and offhand from a few of my real life friends who listened to the show too. They brought up, what is our second favorite Final Fantasy game? So what is our favorite Final Fantasy game that isn't Final Fantasy VIII? And this is a complex question, because this is a complex series.
Yeah.
With complex thoughts around it.
Allow me to try to contextualize this.
Go ahead.
In a number of popular series, if you were asked, what was your favorite entry in it? There might be this linear list of values and qualities that goes up as you start ranking entries in the series, culminating at the point where this game is the most this way of this series, and that's why I love it. That's not how Final Fantasy works. There isn't a game that's like Final Fantasy VIII, but less so.
Or more so.
That's just not how it works with Final Fantasy VIII. Or put another way, the qualities that make VIII our favorite are not qualities that appear in any other Final Fantasy game in any kind of appreciable quantity.
Yeah, there's no like, oh, we had the ATB system, we had the draw system, here's draw 2.0 in Final Fantasy 15.
Or draw 0.5.
Yep.
So with that said, we can still answer this, but keep in mind that it's not going to be for the exact same reasons that they're liked or favored by us.
Yeah. So I think they're going to come with like, you know, this is my favorite blah, blah, blah Final Fantasy. This is my favorite Final Fantasy to X or to Y. So would you like to go first?
I can actually make it quite simple. I think
what?
If
That's
I
fun. Make it complicated.
I know. After all of that discussion of like how it's so complicated, I think I could actually make it quite simple. I think my second favorite Final Fantasy after 8 would probably be 6, except that I didn't finish it. Everything I played about 6, I adored. I adore everything about how concisely and well it can tell backstory and get you invested in so many characters so quickly, so well. 6 is amazing for that. But I didn't finish it. I think it's a bit unfair for me to put up what I perceive to be the amazingness of 6 to what might actually be. And the other...
How far did you get in 6?
Not even to World of Ruin.
That's a really, so I think six is, I would put six pretty highly. Yeah. I think six is a really interesting game, and like, it's a very great, concise, like all the things you said are true. Mm. And I know some people are really into World of Ruin, and I think World of Ruin is fine. Mm-hmm. I think it definitely loses a lot of what makes it so joyously great. But at that point, you're so invested that it's easy to look past the sort of lack of structure that the last half has.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, what I mean is I didn't get the full experience of six. Mm. So with that in mind, the other game that's like really high up there for me, I really like nine. Nine has really good characters. And the only like thing that really turns me off from nine is that Zidane, Monkey Boy, is a really weak feeling protagonist. And then I feel better about it when I just correct myself and say, yeah, well, it's not his story. It's Garnet slash Dagger's story.
Mm.
And when you think about it in that terms, nine is really, really good as well.
Yeah. So I also like six and nine. Like, if I were to put down, this is just like my favorite as like a complete package, despite the criticism I threw at it just then, six is like the game to play in this series. I enjoy nine as like, I just want to like sit down and play something that's comfortable. Nine is like my go-to thing, and the new versions that let you automatically learn abilities from items without grinding for them, like really just punch up that game to a nice quick pace that you can do at a low level and engage with all like the armor systems. It's just a nice game to just like run through.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking criteria, like nine is my favorite game to play. Six is like my favorite game as a complete package. But the Final Fantasy 13 trilogy are my favorite to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Like of all my Final Fantasy thoughts, there have been more spent on 13, 13-2, and Lightning Returns than any other game in the franchise, games in the franchise. There is so much like interesting stuff to think about and discuss and to consider in how those games are made and exist and play that I think I probably just can think about them more than any other game in the series for a long time.
Yep.
So it's like, I have a lot of favorites for extremely different reasons. I think that if I was going to tell someone like, you got to play some Final Fantasy, I'd probably, if they were interested in like the study academical side of things, I'd throw them the 13 trilogy more than I would the arguably much better 6 and the more personally beloved 9.
That's very fair. Yeah. Was Chrono Trigger in the running for this?
Do you define it as a Final Fantasy game?
In my head it is.
Then it's eligible.
Like, there aren't Warriors of Light saving you from the Demon Lord, right? But
I mean, there are Warriors of Light. They find the light of the magic within themselves at the end of time. It counts. It's fine enough.
Then honorable mention to Chrono Trigger, because I love the theories around like story writing, about story structure, about how to write in general, right? It's so such a cool aspect of humanity is history and how to tell stories. And one aspect of storytelling that is such a dangerous thing to play with is time travel. And I'm not saying Chrono Trigger is the most amazing time travel story. It's not. It has holes in its time travel, but it makes the time travel personal.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really good things that Chrono Trigger does with like its storytelling that are very impressive. There's a great video that I'm going to put in the show notes that I don't remember the title of, but it basically is a really strong breakdown of like the dialogue in Chrono Trigger, what its goals are in terms of like mechanical accomplishment and narrative accomplishment.
Mm.
That is really interesting. Lots of bar charts, everything you need in the video.
Yeah.
But also a really interesting and different kind of breakdown of what makes Chrono Trigger great.
Yeah.
If I was going to include Chrono Trigger in this list, I'd probably cut out six.
Yeah.
And replace it with Chrono Trigger.
Yeah.
But nine would still be like in that same evaluation spot of like being the thing I just want to play most.
Cool.
After eight, of course.
After eight.
We also got a voicemail in our new voicemail system that I implemented from Carlos from Two Fat Guys Talk, which is a lovely, much more casual banter sort of podcast that I've listened to occasionally. Let's listen to his voicemail.
Hello, Ruin and Blue. Carlos Faro here. I love Platforms and Pitfalls. Hands down, the best gaming-related podcast on the web. Good work. Fantastic work. On the topic of dominant strategies, I've been revisiting the classic Doom series lately, and I find that while the games allow you to play careful and slow and quick save every few steps, they also lend themselves well to a YOLO strategy, so much so that in many cases, turning my brain off, relying on reaction and instinct, believing in the heart of the cards, as it were, ends up being the winning move. Have you encountered games where you discovered the same, and how did it change your approach in those games and others? Thank you for answering my voicemail and for the podcast. It's truly wonderful. Cheers, guys.
Thank you so much for the positive compliments. It's very vain to agree with them, but thank you so much. So, the general premise of this, if I've interpreted it right, is that, you know, as a lot of players do, you can play through very casually, very carefully. But at some point, you often discover, actually, you don't need to be that careful. You can, like, just lash out and do what seems fun and interesting and bizarre.
Yeah.
And Doom really facilitates that. I haven't actually played Doom, but I get the impression that's pretty true in general. For me, a game that really resonates with this voicemail is actually Fire Emblem.
Okay.
So a lot of people know that Fire Emblem is difficult, and they know that Fire Emblem is difficult and punishing. It's like, if a character dies, I'm going to reset and play again so I don't lose them, because the game is hard. And if I lose characters, it will get harder. So this is partially the game miscommunicates through both itself and the community that this is going to be necessary, and players fall into this trap. But the games are really well designed around the fact that you're going to lose characters pretty constantly. Like, most cast sizes in Fire Emblem are about double the amount of chapters in the game. So you can churn through a character or two every single battle and have a roster at the end. And they're built for that.
But what if they don't get strong enough?
Well, often the characters you get later start off stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start the game with like level 1 units, at the end of the game when you pick up a new unit, there might be a promoted class at like level 10 or 15,
mm-hmm.
and they'll be adequate for the current content.
Okay.
Like, you're never going
to... I knew that, I just wanted to devil's advocate for it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and like, that's the fear. That's exactly the fear. But once I realized how generous Fire Emblem was with its new characters, I was able to just, like, sometimes let people die. And that really just smoothed out the entire game massively.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, what am I missing out on? A few characters. Yes, it's vaguely more optimal to keep everyone alive, because I get better stat growth because characters you get earlier are technically stronger in the long run quite often.
Yep.
But actually, you can just play and lose some characters, and it's fine, and it's good.
I would like to take an opportunity here to also thank Carlos. You put a big smile on my face, and that's very, very kind of you to say, and I'm not sure if all of it was deserved, but thank you very much.
He's a very honest man, is the impression I get, so he's probably telling the truth.
Thank you.
We probably deserve it, maybe.
We're probably just the best. Humble, too. As for a game that is normally careful and slow, but that you can also just kind of throw caution to the wind for,
it's not that the game is normally slow, because Doom is pretty fast, isn't it?
Original Doom? No, you can play original Doom pretty slow. You can, like,
corners
and like lure monsters into your sight lines. They have better better ways of fighting them and stuff like that.
Well, don't mind me. Go on then.
I mean, yeah, it does cater to a variety of speeds. Original Doom actually does work. Is most fun when you like engage and fight and potentially take damage at every turn and be frustrated at how much damage you're taking and how little life you have. I don't know. The games that come to mind are obviously the remakes of Doom, you know, with rewarding you for going in while you're fighting. I thought of Devil May Cry 5 for some reason, but I don't know. I guess that game doesn't feel that careful and slow most of the time.
More about like the going all out and just trying things that may not be safe as opposed to being slow.
Yeah. And there is an aspect of that with Devil May Cry. But the thing that really comes to mind for me when I stop to think about this are speedrun strats. Because a lot of going fast in games, especially for speedrun purposes, there is no in-between of careful and slow to I do the thing that goes the fastest. You just, like, a speedrun strat is something that is, you know, so out there in terms of what you would normally do in play. And then also happens to be faster. For example, like in Mario Odyssey, in I believe the kingdom is Lost Kingdom, the one where you crash land And
oh, yes, that sounds right.
After when you're trying to go across the bridge, Klepto the bird comes and steals Cappy away. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. Cool. I'm with you at this point.
And the common speedrun strat is to skip that sequence entirely, skip Klepto entirely by doing a hard jump off to the left and getting onto the other side and getting rid of Klepto before the cutscene ever triggers.
Oh.
And like, to me, that's the kind of stuff that I want to learn how to do more of. Because I see the good Mario Odyssey speedrunners and they play so freeform. Like I saw a Mario Odyssey speedrunner do Luigi's Balloon World and he's so confident in his movements. And it's such a simple situation of, oh, they put this out of bounds? Okay, fine, I'll do it here. You know, just so confident with how to just go out of bounds and feels like they're playing completely freeform. And I love that kind of play. That kind of play is the kind of play I like to do in fighting games as well, where it's not very calculated and I'm just throwing moves out there. A horrible answer to the question, but...
Well, as Mario speedruns are more, like, they appear very freeform, but they're well rehearsed, right?
They're reasonably well rehearsed, but there are definitely sections that are... Like, sometimes you make micro mistakes and you have to correct for them, and sometimes those corrections require you to have very, very intimate knowledge of the systems to be able to muscle memory out the correct moves on Mario. Like, Mario in Super Mario Odyssey moves unlike any other Mario in any other Mario game. He has so much movement possible. An example of this is there is a world record for minimum number of captures, where you're trying to capture as few things as possible to get through the game. And that number currently is 3. In order to avoid one of the wire captures in Bowser's Kingdom, you have to use a nut that you normally throw into, like a seed that you normally throw into a flower pot that will give you a moon. You have to use that, throw it, jump at the nut, catch it in midair to throw it and jump and to gain height that way. And I've heard that described as the throws and jumps are never quite exactly the same. That you have to watch it to be able to, like, you know, get to adjust for the very tiny variations. This isn't quite answering the spirit of the question, but yeah, that's what I think of, where you're trying to go fast and so you have to do this like crazy complicated, crazy fun trick in exchange for it.
But I guess it is because it's like, rather than being like a meticulously practiced speedrun, it's a speedrun that by necessity requires constant improvisation.
In that sequence, at least.
And there is, and like Mario is just like a very analog character and very analog system.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, I mean, in digital space, nothing is truly analog, but like,
no,
there's so much variation, like you can't just have a pure prediction.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe a better example would be there are certain roguelikes that don't use seed generation to do speedruns for, and those are really cool as well, because you have to play super fast and super close to death all the time to be able to get the most out of your run in the time that you have. I'm struggling to think of an example off the top of my head at the moment, but I know there are a couple of like roguelikes. Even Minecraft has an unseeded challenge category, you know, where, you know, the goal is still like to kill the Ender Dragon, but because it's unseeded, you don't know where all the resources specifically are, and you have to just kind of run around and do things on the fly. And if you've never seen a Minecraft speedrun, there's a section where you have to farm Ender Pearls of Endermen. And what they do is they just go into the desert and wander around and keep trying to cross sections to cause Endermen to spawn. And the moment they do, they look at it to get the Endermen to teleport to them and then look down and within the span of like 2 seconds, build a fortification where they're under the sand and they can slash out at the Endermen's feet, but the Endermen cannot hurt them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, like they do that. If you've never seen it, Fortnite players do this as well, where they do like speed builds. They do that in Minecraft to kill Endermen. And that's
names are cool.
It's so cool, but like that's such a crazy YOLO strat to kill an Enderman, right? Like, yeah, I'm just gonna get him to teleport to me, and while he's doing that, I'm gonna look down at the ground, build this like tiny dugout in the ground where I can hit the Enderman, but the Enderman cannot hit me. It's really impressive. Like, that's such a degree of technical dexterity to be able to do that.
It is.
Yeah.
We got one last bit of response from someone. So from Jude of Aromatic Games blog, they wrote a post that sort of goes through our recent Dominant Strategy series and responds to a lot of it, adding in their own thoughts, bringing up a lot of different examples like uni races and stacking as like things that do similar things to what we talked about, but taking them in different and distinct directions. Mm-hmm. It's very humbling, honestly, to have like this many words written about a thing that we made. Mm-hmm. But also there's a lot of just like good ideas and good things that you could look at potentially in here that I think our listeners would really enjoy having at least a quick skim through. There'll be a link to that in the show notes. And thank you very much, Jude, for your writing again.
Yeah, thank you.
And with that, I think we'll lead into our ending notes. And with that, we'll look towards the future. So over the last year and a half or so, we've done a lot of different things. We've done some guest episodes, some swap episode, a live show even. We've looked at a more historical aspect through the Platforms of Pitfalls crossover and the Game of the Year stuff. So in the future, we now have a better idea of what we want to focus on. Like, we've established what I think we care about in our discussions a lot through these experiments. We're still going to have like some unique things, like we might have some future like mini series, we're gonna have some crossovers hopefully in the future too, but yeah, we've done a lot of experimenting. I think we've honed in what we want out of this.
Yeah, a year and a half is quite a bit of time, even at once a month recording at a time.
A lot of thought that goes into what we're doing each month though.
Yeah,
a lot of time to review.
And
I'm really glad with like how far we've come, and I hope that in another year and a half we'll be even further from where we started in a good sense.
In a sense
of refinement.
A lot of personal circumstances have changed across the year and a half as well, hence...
We've both moved.
Yeah, the slight chaoticness of... Last year was a hard year. 2019 was a very hard year. I am willing to admit that.
This is the year that's canonically supposed to be hard, but in terms of like us individually, like last year we just had a lot of movement for ourselves in our lives.
Yeah. And so I take the silver lining of, because we weren't stable in a lot of the things that was happening personally, we got to experiment with a few things, and that helped us lock in a bit more on what the format for Platforms and Pitfalls, or at least what we feel works the best.
So yeah, it should be very exciting moving forwards, and we have a potential new thing coming up, don't we?
Yeah. There is a series that I pitched last year, when a lot of things were like kind of going all over the place. Experimenting with the idea of a more rambly version of us just talking to each other, where we focus specifically on one thing. We did an episode. I was going to call it a test record, but no, we did an episode that I don't think will see the light of day because time and separation and a lot of personal reasons mean that I won't get around to ever finishing editing that correctly. But we recently re-recorded a new episode for that. I guess
it's very good, if I say so myself.
I guess we can name it, right? We can call it what it is. It's probably going to be called On This Hill, as a kind of podcast outlet for us to just have a less structured, less researched, and more focused,
passionate.
Yeah, like rant is a disingenuous word here. Extended monologue, minor dialogue about a topic.
Hmm. The hills in which we would die on.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
And so, they won't be as heavily edited or controlled as a normal Platforms and Pitfalls episode. And I don't think it'll ever replace a monthly Platforms and Pitfalls episode.
Yeah, it'll always be additional. If we get a lot of them, they'll get their own feed, but I think until we get them vaguely consistent, they'll be on this feed for now.
Yeah, there is no planned schedule. It's just something that we often talk a lot amongst ourselves, between us, around recordings. And not to toot our own horn, some of it's decent. And so we're trying to find a place for some of that. Yeah, we're trying to find a place for some of that to live. So do bear with us as we you know, keep experimenting. But at the same time, we are aiming to keep the quality and level of platforms and pitfalls.
Pitfalls and platforms. Platforms and pitfalls. I know the name of our show.
That show. As consistent
that show
as
that we
possible.
Make, we can remember the title of totally.
That was very embarrassing. But you
we
get
could
the
edit
idea.
It out. That's
nah,
the beauty of
nah, 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 nah. yeah, we want that to be, you know, a consistent thing, and we're very happy with how it looks and feels at the moment. Mm. So,
and we really appreciate the support. The feedback we get is always positive, and we always encourage you to give us feedback, both good and bad, because it helps us improve the show and take it in ways that help it out. A lot of early feedback was really instrumental in making it a little bit more structured and refined than what it was at the very start. And yeah, we look forward to going more on this journey with you. We appreciate those of you who asked us questions. If we get a lot of questions in future, we might see an earlier addendum than the 18 months between this and the last one. And yeah, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.